Thanks, Marcus. Well, here's my collaborator coming in. So this is going to be a talk about. By the way, Marcus, thanks for arranging for me to talk on the Bastille Day, which of course, coming from France, is an honor. So I'm speaking about strongly coupled CFTs. And why are we interested in strongly coupled CFTs? Well, because we want to contemplate scenarios when we have standard model which is coupled to a CFT. And we know that phenomenologically this can do many useful things for us. So I'll just remind a few of these things. For instance, if the standard model fermions are coupled to the CFT, then you can explain by means of anomalous dimensions. So this CFT is strongly coupled, and the main characteristic of having strong coupling is that it's going to have some dimensions which are vastly different from perturbative field theories. And some of these dimensions, they can trickle down into the standard model. And for instance, this can explain via various runnings flavor hierarchies. That's one possibility that has been discussed. Okay, then there are some possibilities in theory of supersymmetry breaking and mediation. You know, there is one possibility which goes under the name of sequestering, when you basically want to suppress unwanted flavor violations coming from the supersymmetry breaking sector. Then there is another possibility which appears when you try to generate to solve the mu b mu problem, engage mediation. So there's a bunch of possibilities. I'm missing some possibilities. So if you know some other possibilities, please tell me. So I'd like to have a catalog of all useful applications. But I think by far the most exciting possibility, which actually got me thinking about these problems, is when Higgs field of the standard model resides in the CFT. So if somewhere here there's also the Higgs. So we remove the Higgs from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. And what exactly do we mean by that? Well, we imagine something which in the old days was known as walking technicolor. So let me say a few words. So in the technicolor theory, you start with something which is like a technicolor, and then you start increasing or the number of fermions in the technicolor theory, or increasing the size of fermion representations. And as you do this, the gauge coupling constant, if you think in terms of the gauge coupling, it changes, the beta function behavior changes. So in a normal technicolor theory, it's like a QCD, it runs like that, but as you, this is beta and G. As you increase the number of fermions, then it starts running slower and slower, and then maybe at a certain number of fermions, it will even, because of the second loop term, it may even develop behavior like that. And then you say, okay, this point is an infrared fixed point of the theory. And then, if you have such an infrared fixed point, then the fermion bilinear, psi bar psi, well, you got a CFT, and in this CFT you have an operator which has quantum numbers of the Higgs. So this is, I have in mind something like that. Now, it's also, in the old days, when people came up with this idea, the main limitation of thinking about this idea was that we tried thinking about it in terms of gauge degrees of freedom, which is, of course, in a sense self-defeating, because on the one hand, we imagine that the theory is going to be strongly coupled. And if the theory is strongly coupled, it means that, you know, it in a sense lost connection with the microscopic degrees of freedom. And on the other hand, there is nothing else that we had in our disposal, so we kept thinking in terms of psi bar psi. And well, in terms of this analysis, we discovered some limitations. So what were these limitations? So the principal limitation was related to the dimension of this operator psi bar psi. Because in Technicolor, this operator, in working Technicolor, you use this operator in order to produce thermal masses. And because this operator has dimension bigger than one, when you couple it to standard model fermions, so you write down an operator like that. It's an irrelevant operator. So you have psi bar psi, q bar q, things like that. And because it's an irrelevant operator, it cannot be generated at an arbitrary high UV scale. So the scale at which it's generated, it's limited. And at the scale where this operator is generated, you can expect various unwanted flavor effects, which are experimentally very much constrained. So it's very crucial, and you know, it was very crucial in working Technicolor, and it's going to be very crucial for us to know what the dimension of this operator is, and how people estimated this operator, this dimension. Well, they used various approximate techniques based essentially on gauge degrees of freedom. For instance, one technique was known as a gap equation. So it's essentially a Schwinger-Dyson approximation for the fermion propagator. So you write something like that. This is a gauge propagator, gauge field propagator, fermion propagator. You know, something which clearly doesn't have to hold in a strongly coupled theory. But for want of better techniques, you use this. And then, for instance, people discovered by these techniques that the dimension of this condensate can basically never become smaller than 2. So it's that what came out of this analysis. And the fact that it's bigger than this dimension is bigger than 2 means that this operator which gives fermion masses is okay, it's not as strongly irrelevant as in normal Technicolor, but it is still pretty irrelevant. And for instance, you cannot really introduce the top mass in this language, because the top Yukawa coupling becomes large at a very nearby scale, and it means that it disturbs the conformal dynamics. So either you have to include top into the whole conformal dynamics, which is called top color. I mean, you have to do something. Anyway, it starts looking very, very complicated. So that was the situation. And then there was an interesting observation by Marcus and by Takemichi in 2004, who said, "Let us not despair," they said, "because we don't have to believe this. After all, this is all based on an approximation, thinking in terms of gauge degrees of freedom. So let us let us calmly formulate, first of all, what is it that we need from our theory?"
Well, it's not just an approximation, it's a truncation.
It's a truncation, approximation, unjustified truncation. So let's not be fooled by this. So let us formulate what it is exactly that we need. And thinking in terms of the CFT data, in terms of the anomalous, in terms of the dimensions of the CFT operator. So what we really need, they said, we are looking for a CFT which should have a global symmetry G, let's call it G. And this global symmetry, for phenomenological reasons, it should be at least as large as SO4, which is SU2 cross SU2. Basically, if you don't want to worry about the T parameter, that's a requirement. And then, if you have this global symmetry, you can classify all the primary operators of the CFT in terms of this symmetry, and you want to have an operator H, which is 2,2 of SU2 cross SU2. And the dimension of this operator H has to be as close to 1 as possible. So let's call it 1 plus epsilon. So that's the first condition that you want to have. And if you have this condition, then this operator that you're going to write, it's going to be not too irrelevant, and presumably you can postpone all the problems with flavor up to very, very high scale. But then what is the, so that's the first condition, but then what is the second condition that replaces the fact that in working technicolor, the CFT was appearing as an infrared fixed point of an asymptotically free gauge theory, they asked. And this, so there is a condition which replaces this. This condition says that the CFT must be infrared stable. And what this means is that, after all, we want to solve the hierarchy problem. And the hierarchy problem means that this CFT that we are considering should not have any strongly relevant perturbations. So, to be a bit more precise, we can classify all relevant perturbations in terms of the symmetry group. And the dangerous ones are those which are singlets under the global symmetry group, because they cannot be forbidden by the symmetry. So if you consider singlets under G, so these are singlet scalar operators. The condition was that the dimension of the singlet has to be, overall singlets has to be bigger than 4. Or actually, you could also consider a condition, a slightly relaxed condition, when this dimension is bigger than 4 minus delta. Which is maybe even interesting, because if the dimension of S is slightly smaller than 4 but bigger than 4 minus delta, then it means that there is a natural way for the CFT to eventually flow out of the fixed point, because we don't want our CFT be completely stable. Eventually, the electric symmetry has to break, so the CFT has to flow out. And if there is an operator which is very weakly relevant, then this provides a natural way to flow out. If there is no such operator, then you have to do something else. Then you have to assume that the group is bigger. There is a way to do it also. Okay, so these were the two conditions, and this reformulation, they called it conformal technicolor. So you can say quantitatively what exactly you need about these two numbers, epsilon and delta. I'm going to maybe say something later. But for the present discussion, for instance, if these two numbers are of order 1/3, 1/4, then it would be very, very good phenomenologically. Now, this reformulation, I think, was a really major step forward, because it really freed us from this, from keeping thinking in terms of gauge degrees of freedom. It should not matter what are the microscopic degrees of freedom. Forget about microscopic degrees of freedom. It doesn't matter what the Higgs operator is made of. Is it made of Technic works or Technic gluons? Or, Technic cucumbers and Technic tomatoes? It doesn't really matter. What matters is that there is a fixed point, there are these conditions on the dimensions, and now we just have to think hard and decide this is a sufficiently sharp formulation that we should decide whether there is some fundamental reason why such CFTs may or may not exist. So that's the point. And you know, you may think that that's precisely the kind of question that string theorists are paid to know answers for. But you know, unfortunately, since 1997, string theorists are doing ADS-CFT, and in ADS-CFT, these two conditions cannot be realized. And the reason why they cannot be realized is that, as you notice, these two conditions, so that we can rewrite them as delta S has to be bigger than twice delta H plus something of order 1. And on the other hand, there is one way to get an operator S out of operator H, namely if you consider the OP H times H dagger, then in this OP, you know, there are going to be various scalar operators, and you know, one of these scalar operators that you can schematically call H H dagger, okay, it's a composite operator. But there's going to be an operator of quantum numbers, of singlet quantum numbers. There's going to be a totally singlet operator. So this is an S. And now in ADS-CFT, there is, in four dimensions, there is a relation that there is an approximate factorization. So the dimension of H, H dagger in ADS-CFT, it's always equal to twice the dimension of H plus corrections of order 1 over n. So basically, you can say that in ADS-CFT, you can only describe conformal field theories which live very closely to a Gaussian theory. This Gaussian theory may have large anomalous dimensions by itself, but nevertheless, it's nearly Gaussian. And what we need here, what we are looking here for, is a theory which is very strongly non-Gaussian. So that's the crucial difference. Well, you may ask, but perhaps such large deviations are just impossible. Well, actually, we don't know of any four-dimensional theories which have such large deviations, but in low dimensions, we know from our experience from low-dimensional CFTs says that, yes, such things are possible. And just to give one example, if you consider the critical fixed point of Ising model, Ising ferromagnet. So it's a CFT with a Z2 global symmetry. So Ising model. Then in two dimensions, so this Ising model has an OPE which is very similar to this OPE. So it has two primary operators, sigma and epsilon, and the OP is like this, sigma times sigma equals epsilon. And in two dimensions, the dimension of operator sigma is equal to 1/8, which jumps to 1 when you take the OP. And this is an exactly solvable model, so we know these numbers exactly. And in three dimensions, which is not exactly solvable, but there are a variety of approximate techniques that you can treat it, the dimension of sigma is approximately 0.52, and the dimension of epsilon is approximately 1.4. So you see, in both of these examples, there is a significant jump in the anomalous dimension when you go from sigma to epsilon. So, you know, if you take this as an intuition, then perhaps it's not such a crazy thing that a theory satisfying these two requirements may exist. Who knows?
Is there any empirical tendency known? Higher the dimension becomes, the jump becomes smaller, or not?
Well, you see, the moment you come to four dimensions, you know nothing. So, so we cannot continue this series.
At least two dimensions, three dimensions.
Well, you can try to extrapolate from two points, but I didn't do this exercise. Okay, so that's that was the situation, and now before. I think that was enough of a motivation, and now let me formulate one of our results. Let me formulate the result. I'm going to write down, now I'm going to become slightly more rigorous than I used to be. Until now, so I'm going to consider an OPE. So I'm focusing on this case G equals SO4. And I'm going to write down the OPE in real notation. So I'm, instead of talking about H, which is 2,2, I'm going to use phi A, which is fundamental of SO4. And I'm going to write OPE in the form phi A of X, phi b of 0, and now I'm going to write down the general symmetry structure of this OPE. First of all, there are going to be singlets appearing in this OPE, and among singlets there is a unit iterator, always, and then there's going to be a bunch of singlets, not only scalars, but they will appear with all possible even spins. So these are going to be even spins. In particular, among these operators, there's going to be my operator S, the one which I want to study, the singlet scalar, the lowest dimension singlet scalar. But there are going to be also other interesting operators. For instance, there's always going to be present the stress energy tensor among these fields. And there's going to be infinitely many other operators. Then, but these are not all operators. There are going to be also operators which have tensor structure of traceless symmetric tensor. Call them TAB. And these operators will also appear in all even spins. I don't know, so I'm not being prejudiced. And finally, there's going to be operators which will have structure of, and there are going to be many of them. And finally, there are going to be operators which are anti-symmetric tensors in this flavor indices. And these ones will have odd spin. And one privileged operator among these operators is the symmetry current. So in general, I know that the stress tensor has dimension 4, the symmetry current has dimension 3, but I don't know much, the dimensions of other operators are not fixed. This is something that the theory should tell me. For instance, if you take a free scalar theory, not strongly interacting by free, it should also fit this scheme, of course, because a free theory is a CFT. And then in a free theory, we know that, of course, we know that S is just phi squared, so it has dimension 2. And also T, we know the T, it's phi A, phi B, minus, and we have to subtract the trace. And it also has dimension 2. So in the free theory, both of these fields have dimension 2, but in a strongly interacting theory, we don't know a priori what the dimension of these fields is. We didn't know in 2007 when we started working on this, 2006, but now we do know something. So let me give the result. So we can show rigorously, if you wish, the following thing. So if we fix the dimension of phi to lie somewhere on this horizontal line, you know, the dimension of phi has to be always bigger than 1 by unitarity, but it can vary for 1, 2, and so on. And on this, on the vertical axis, I'm going to plot the dimension of S. You know, we know that this point corresponds to the free theory, the 1-2 plot, the 1-2 point. So somewhere here I have the so let me draw the ADS CFT line. So this is delta S equals twice delta phi. This is the ADS CFT line. So we know that on this line there are theories. They are not phenomenologically interesting, but they are there. So what we do know, on the other hand, is that we can draw this curve, which I will call delta max. And the result is that, you know, if you tell me what the value of dimension of phi is, then I can show rigorously that the dimension of S has to lie below this curve. So this whole region is excluded. So that's the result. This is for SL4 global symmetry. So this result is okay. It's a fruit of work of many people, in particular Ricardo, Eric Tonni. Then Alessandro Vicchi was absolutely fundamental contributor. And actually, this particular plot that I'm drawing here, you know, it's not even published. It's because, you know, we improve as time goes on. So this particular plot, I think, it's due to Vicky and David Poland and David Simmons Duffin. So that's the result, and now I'd like to make several comments.
Sorry. Yeah. Are you gonna explain what that curve is?
Yeah, I'm going to explain. But no, it's not, it's a numerical result.
And what's the basis of the...
Yeah, I'm going to explain that later on. So you know, on the basis of this curve, we can make some conclusions about the viability of this conformal technicolor idea. So it turns out that you know, the region in which you have to live in conformal technicolor, it's limited by two lines. First of all, you have to live absolutely for the dimension of phi below than 1.5. So this is a very robust assumption, a very robust requirement that basically, independently of how optimistic you want to be about the structure of flavor theory at the UV scale, there is always going to be there's always going to be this diagram. where you exchange, you know, for instance, S, D, D, S. And this diagram, even though it's even if you assume that the theory at UV scale is completely minimally is, you know, respects flavor symmetry, so it's minimally flavor violating, and these couplings of the Higgs to the quarks, they by construction they respect also flavor symmetries. I mean, they are broken just by Yukawa couplings, the flavor symmetries. This diagram, so it gives you a minimally flavor violating contribution, but this contribution becomes large, you know, it becomes above the bounds, existing bounds, if the dimension of H or dimension of phi bigger than 1.5, about 1.5.
You have delta max crossing at 1.5, is that, you know that?
It's accidental, yeah. Currently it's crossing at about 1.5. No, but it does cross very close. Yeah, it does cross very close to 1.5. And then there is this line, which you know, that you have to live above this line. It basically comes from the requirement that you want to maintain natural hierarchy at least up to the scale of the flavor of generating the Yukawa couplings, because if the dimension of S is, you know, it's two or, you know, anyway below this line, then you're basically you're getting back the hierarchy problem. You know, it may be a bit surprising that you can live as low as, you know, 3 or 3.5, but actually it comes from the reason that we don't want to maintain naturalness up to an arbitrary high scale or Planck scale. For instance, if you live somewhere here, then the UV scale of this theory is of the order of 100 TeV. So it's not very, very high. And, you know, to maintain hierarchy up to 100 TeV, then it turns out that the dimension 3.5 is sufficient of S. With the tuning of 10%, yeah. So, as you can see, this bound, there is some region of parameter space which is consistent with the bound. So it's possible that somewhere here, there are theories which can be consistent with our bound and lead to a conformal technicolor scenario of electric symmetry breaking. But one conclusion that we can draw is that these theories, they do have to respect some kind of, they cannot allow for complete flavor anarchy at the scale of the lambda UV.
So let me understand this kick about more.
Yeah.
You said no matter what the flavor structure is, suppose you just think Yukawa minimal flavor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then this is essentially Yukawa couplings.
This is essentially Yukawa couplings.
You go to the basis where that's diagonal.
Yeah, it's completely diagonal.
Then why this operator is on lambda?
This is the top.
Here, of course, the
here
top.
Is the charge curve in any way, right? Is the charge curve.
So this diagram has precisely the same.
Making S2W.
No, I'm saying something very nice. So I'm saying that this diagram, it has exactly the same structure as the standard W exchange diagram.
Yeah.
But it just happens to have a big coefficient, which is computable, or can be estimated.
Because the Yukawas grow in the scale. The Yukawas now are irrelevant operators, so they grow with the momentum. So you have to recompute the diagram with Yukawas that
you can compute this diagram basically, and you find that all, so if the dimension is equal to 1.5, then basically all scales between lambda infrared and lambda UV contribute equally, and if the dimension is bigger than 1.5, then this diagram is even UV dominated, so you are killed by this diagram.
You're saying Jim becomes worse.
The coefficient.
Just the coefficient.
If you are above 1.5, the symmetry of the model times the ratio of the UV over the air scale to positive power.
Yeah.
So.
Is there something more bigger you have a couple?
Yes, I was worried that
No, but that you know, if there are some extra, if the mixings are not exactly like in the standard model, then there are other contributions. But this contribution is always going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, does this bound? I remember I checked this for the case where you go up to the largest scale possible, maybe where the Tapu-Kawa gets very big. But if you push the flavor scale lower, this bound goes away, right?
Yeah. Because
you, the standard model times, as you said, this ratio of the flavor scale to the TEV scale.
Yeah, so.
So you can also partly ameliorate this by taking that small.
Yeah, you could do this. Yeah, you could do this. But as I say, even for 1.5, conformal technicolor operates already in a pretty narrow window from 1 TeV to 100 TeV. You know, if you ameliorate this, then, you know, then the window shrinks, and then perhaps we should call it something differently. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we wrote down these models where the UV completion of this, and in those models, the highest flavor scale you could get away with was 10 TeV.
10 TeV, yeah. But it's less ambitious in a sense because you are not taking advantage of the conformal symmetry so much.
Right.
Yeah. So here we want. I mean, the motivation that we took from your work is, you know, if you really appeal to something as exciting and as conformal symmetry, then okay, let's try to use it all the way, not just in some very short window from 1 TeV to 10 TeV. And then some completely different thing happens. So we were hoping that, you know, it could be something as exciting as conformal symmetry all the way up to very high scale. But I mean, so I should make two comments about this. First, let me make a comment that this bound is a bound on a singlet, but actually we can also derive a bound on this symmetric traceless tensor, which looks something like that. So this is delta max of TAB. So this is an interesting thing. It tells us that that it's important, in a sense, to keep the dimension of the symmetric traceless operator lower. So the symmetric traceless operator is, in a sense, more important for the consistency of the theory than the singlet. And it also has some consequences, phenomenological consequences for the S parameter, for the S parameter story in this kind of scenario. So if you're interested, ask me later. And another thing is that we have looked at how the bound changes if you increase the symmetry group of the theory. So here I gave it for SO4, but you could try other groups, SO5 and so on, SO6, or maybe SUN groups. Well, SUNs we haven't even looked at yet, but for what we noticed is that if you increase the symmetry, then this bound relaxes. So actually, this could be taken as a hint that, you know, the phenomenologically relevant models perhaps have a bigger symmetry, not just the very minimal scenario SO4, but bigger symmetry. And which, by the way, also bigger symmetry may mean that this could be not a technicolor model in the infrared, but something like a composite Higgs model. So this kind of connection exists. All right.
And anything the dependence on the dimension?
Just empirically, we see that if you increase space-time dimension.
You can do the same thing, right?
Well, we did the same thing, yeah, also in two dimensions, in order to compare with minimal models and so on, yeah.
And then,
it works.
No, is there any dependence?
It's difficult. No, I mean it's difficult to compare because really, know, in one case you know theories which saturate the bound, like in two dimensions, and in four dimensions you
repeat the same technique.
Yeah, it was repeated.
Yeah, it was repeated.
And then any tendency for probably changing.
Well, what we saw in two dimensions is that there are certain models, like the easing model, which turns out to saturate the bound. And then the bound basically interpolates between known theories, like known minimal models. But which is nature, of course, you cannot violate. So for instance, if we didn't know that the easing model existed, then by making this kind of analysis, you would discover a bound, and then you would see, well, this bound has a kink at this point. Well, if it has a kink, then probably there is some theory which leaves at this kink, and this is the easing model.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to know something other than easing.
It's difficult. No, I mean, it's again 2, 3, 4.
It's a different structure.
For instance,
different structure. Linear dimension. Yeah. Linear has a kink.
In two dimensions, it's linear at zero. I mean, it intercepts zero at zero.
No, it doesn't have intercept zero. It has intercept four.
In two dimensions.
No, because of I can explain later why it hasn't.
Slope four
intercepts zero.
Because in your first paper, the intercept wasn't.
Yeah, the first one was very low number of derivatives.
Oh, but so it does go to zero when you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay, so that's the result, and now let me tell something about how we get it. And basically, what I want to, my goal here is to explain that this is something really, this is not a difficult type of analysis. This is something that everyone can do. You don't have to have us to do this. If you have some interesting problem where you think this kind of bounds could give some insights, you can do it yourself. And the only thing that you need is a small toolkit. So let's call it CFT Bounds Toolkit. And so what does this toolkit include? So first of all, I already mentioned some things. So first of all, you have to have OPE. And that we understand. Then the second thing that you need to know is you need to know some basic consequences of unitarity. And unitarity gives you two things. So first of all, it tells you that the dimension of operator of spin L is necessarily bigger than L plus 1. No, sorry, L plus 2. And this is for L starting from 1. And for scalars, it's bigger than 1. So these are the unitarity bounds for operator dimensions. This is one consequence of unitarity. And the second thing you have to use, which is also a consequence of unitarity, is that the OPE coefficients appearing in this OPE, which I haven't even written here, they are all real. So OPE coefficients real. And then you need to know a slightly more advanced technique, which is called conformal blocks. So let me say a few words. So basically what it means, what conformal blocks mean, is that when you take an OPE, let's for instance take an OPE of two scalars, and suppose that this OPE contains another scalar, call it O. Then actually, if a certain scalar enters an OPE, then also its derivatives will appear in the same OPE. That's the usual story, and then high derivatives as well. And then it turns out that in the conformal theory, the coefficients with which all these derivatives enter the OPE, they're completely fixed by the symmetry. And you know, the way you can derive them, for instance, you can take the three-point function, and And you must have heard that in the conformal theory, a three-point function is completely fixed in terms of dimensions of operators. Now, if you expand this three-point function around x equals 0 and you substitute the OPE here, then you basically, so on the one hand, you know the exact expression for this three-point function. It's something like a constant divided by x to the power delta phi, twice delta phi minus delta o, y to the power delta o, x minus y to the power delta o. On the other hand, you expand, you substitute the OPE, and this is given by the two-point function of o plus d mu o o plus and so on. So if you match, if you expand this and you match, you can really compute all the all coefficients. And then you can do another thing. Now you can go to a four-point function level. And then if you use the OPE on the left-hand side, and if you use the same OPE on the right-hand side, and if you connect, then you basically reduce a four-point function to an infinite sum of two-point functions of operator O and its derivatives times certain coefficients. So this whole series can be summed up in closed form. And when you sum it up, it gives you something like 1 over x to x12 to the power twice delta phi, x34 to the power 2 delta phi times a function of cross ratios. So these two things, u and v, are the conformal cross ratios. So it has to be like that. So basically, conformal symmetry tells you that it has to be like that. But the amazing thing is that you can actually do this computation and you find this function g in closed form. And this is what is called conformal block. And it's basically a combination of hypergeometric functions. So it's a known function. Okay, so you have to know this. And then this whole contribution to the four-point function is proportional to the square of the OPE coefficient. So you get a sum in this conformal blocks times OPE coefficient squared. Yeah, so this conformal block depends on the dimension of the operator that you exchange and on the spin of the operator that you exchange. Okay, this is point three. Then point four is crossing symmetry. Well, this is this should be clear. So you can. So if you use this OPE for each operator which appears in the OPE, if you use this for every operator, so you represent the four-point function as a sum over all the operators which appear in the OPE. But now you can do the same thing using picking a different pair of operators. And crossing symmetry tells you that if you do this in two different ways, then this has to agree. So you see, in this sense, this conformal theory is more like string theory. You don't there is duality between channels. You don't sum, when you compute a four-point function, you don't sum over channels. Rather than you impose that both channels should give you the same answer. So this is like, you can call it OPE associativity. And basically, so this, you can write it, this equation, you can write it like that, if you wish. 1 over u to the power delta phi times the sum over all operators O, the OPE coefficient squared times conformal block of u and v. This object has to be invariant under interchange of u and v. This is an equation. This is a constraint of crossing symmetry, because going from S channel to T channel basically interchanges these two cross ratios U and V. Okay, then A fifth thing that you have to use is a little group theory. And this is really very, very little group theory. So this group theory appears because when you do this, when you study this constraint in a theory which has global symmetry, like which I just erased, then each symmetry channel, each representation that you exchange, it will give you a certain tensor structure in external indices. And when you do the same decomposition in the T channel, you will get the same set of tensor structures, but with a different assignment of indices. And then, you know, since it's the same set of tensor structures you are dealing with, there exists a certain matrix. There's a certain Fields matrix that transforms one set of tensor structures into another. So this is a Fields transformation, and you have to take this into account. So really, this is a... So in what follows, I'm going to ignore this little technicality, even though it took us some time to implement it properly. And now I would like to discuss why this whole, why all this toolkit gives you any mileage. So this is the crucial equation, plus a little technicality that you have in case of the global symmetry. And why does it give you any mileage? So in particular, why can't you satisfy this equation trivially by just setting all the coefficients C to zero? And that would give you zero solution, a zero four-point function, and then, of course, that would be invariant. Well, you can't do this because there is always a unit operator which appears in the OPE with a unit coefficient. That's just normalization of the fields. So this equation really looks like 1 over u to the power delta plus dot, dot, dot equals 1 over v to the power delta plus dot, dot, dot. And if that equation is to be satisfied, then better this dot, dot, dot be non-zero. So better some other operators better also have non-zero PE coefficients. So this is crucial. So you can say that the presence of a unit operator in the PE creates a crossing symmetry deficit, and all the other operators should restore the deficit. Okay, and it's going to become clearer if I'm going to rewrite this equation like this: 1 over u to the power u to the power 2 delta phi minus 1 over v to the power twice delta phi equals sum over all the other operators, which are not the unit operator, C delta L squared. And here I have a certain function F delta L UV, which is a linear combination of conformal blocks. So you have an equation like that. And in order to understand this equation, you need to have some geometric intuition. So, you know, this is a functional equation. You know, we have functions of u and v. This is a function space. We have infinitely many of these functions because for each spin, a priori, we could have infinitely many dimensions appearing in this equation. So this looks like a mess. And yet it has a simple geometric interpretation. So if you know, this is my infinite dimensional function space. So in my function space, there are all these functions f's. And now I'm considering all possible linear combinations of these functions with positive coefficients. These are positive coefficients. Now, what is this object that you're going, what is this set, what is this subset of the function space that I'm going to get? Well, I'm going to get something which you can call a convex cone. It's going to be a convex cone. And so the question then becomes whether the function which I have here in the left-hand side belongs to this convex cone or doesn't belong to it. So you have, if my left-hand side doesn't belong to the cone, then it means that a CFT, which corresponds to the choice of basis vectors on the right-hand side, cannot exist. Doesn't exist to unitary CFT. If, on the other hand, it does, then perhaps such a CFT exists. Well, that's it. That's the main idea. And what now the last thing that you need to do is you have to do numerics, unfortunately. And, okay, depending on how sophisticated you want to be, I mean, there are various things you can do, but in the end of the day, it all amounts to taking this equation and expanding it, Taylor expanding it around a certain point. Now, it's up to you to choose the point, and the point that we usually were choosing is the point corresponding to four points in my four-point function, x1, x2, x3, x4, being at vertices of a square. And the reason why we're choosing this combination, this configuration, is very simple. It's simply because this is a configuration which makes it the relation of S and T channels most democratic, that you can imagine. So it's completely symmetric. So you take that equation, you expand it, you Taylor expand it around this point. So instead of one functional equation, you get a certain number of, a finite number of equations, linear equations. And, but it still has infinitely many terms in the right-hand side. Well, that you have to discretize. So you have to truncate the spins, and you have to discretize the dimensions. And then at the end of the day, you have a finite system of equations. And the only thing that you have to, the only slightly unusual thing that you have is that all the coefficients have to be positive. Now, it turns out that systems of equations with positive coefficients are almost as easy to solve numerically as systems of equations without such a restriction. So for a strange reason, it is not being taught in standard courses of linear algebra, but this is called linear programming problem, and Mathematica has a common linear programming which basically solves this system for you.
Sorry, you're solving for the dimensions given the scene.
No, I'm making an assumption about the spectrum of my CFT. For instance, I'm making an assumption that the lowest scalar which appears in the PE has such and such dimension. So this amounts to choosing a certain basis in the right-hand side. And I'm also fixing the dimension of phi. So I'm doing analysis for each dimension of phi separately. So once I fix these two numbers, I have a certain basis, I have a certain cone. Now I discretize everything brutally, and the computer spits out the answer. Then you can go and you can try to understand various features of this answer analytically or semi-analytically. For instance, the fact that this bound behaves like a square root near the origin. That we can understand analytically. But to really get that shape of the bound and to improve it to the extent as to be able to say something useful about Marcus's scenario, that you have to do some extensive numerical analysis. So you put it in the computer and you play the game, and the codes are available, so put some codes on the net, and we'll put some more detailed tutorial soon. But which game can you play? So you can say, well, we already derived this bound. What else can you do? Well, first of all, I have we only started to scratch the surface, really, because as I told you, we explored SON case, more or less. But for instance, we haven't looked at all at other symmetries like SUN and SUN cross SUN, which are actually phenomenologically the interesting ones. Because if you're thinking about CFTs which appear as an infrared limit of some kind of gauge theory, then those CFTs, they always have global symmetry SU2N or SUN times SUN, and never SON, except for some special cases when these two groups coincide. So this has to be done, and we haven't even started doing this. Another thing that I haven't mentioned is that you can use exactly, so this method is very flexible. You can also use this method to bound the size of OPE coefficients.
Sir, Saul?
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask about the question. What if we use the argument, you're saying that a theory that is the infrared limit of a gauge theory can never have global symmetry?
SON,
I mean, is it specific to four dimensions?
Yeah, I guess specific to four dimensions, yeah. Because the fermions are complex. So strictly speaking, before even making, you know, a sound judgment about the, you know, since we already know that for SON this bound relaxes, and for SU2N and SUN cross SUN it may even relax more, we don't know since we haven't looked, you know, you should be very careful to conclude on the basis of this plot that, well, this idea is ruled out, let's just move on and do something else. No, this story has to be finished, and it has not at all been finished.
For example, I mean, the most plausible theory for this, you took SU2 gauge theory with six flavors, that means 12 biofermions.
Yeah.
That has SU12.
SU12.
That theory is from various lattice and other studies. It's a good, very good guess, but that theory is conformal. And that might be the most plausible.
Exactly. This
is a large N theory, so just, you know, so that's a very natural one to look at.
Yeah, this has to be done, absolutely. Another thing which has to be done or has to be pursued, which is basically in its infancy, are various analyses on the size of OPE coefficients, which you can also do using this method, and you can also bound things like not just OPE coefficients of scalars, but you can also try to bound OPE coefficients of currents, of stress tensor, which are related to the central charge of the theory and the current central charge of the theory, which tells you something about the size of the theory. And this is very interesting. Another interesting thing is that if you are a SUSY aficionado, then, actually I shouldn't erase because it's exactly this, the same set of people. Well, first, the two Davids and then Alessandro wrote the paper on that. They generalized this technique to the SUSY case. And basically their motivation was that in SUSY you know a lot about dimensions of chiral primaries, but you knew nothing about the dimensions of operators which appear in the OPEs of chiral primaries. And just like here, we could, you know, use the OPE to learn something and to put bounds. It turns out in the SUSY case you can also do this. And there is some qualitative difference which transpires from this analysis. And basically, in the SUSY case, it turns out that the bound that you get is not quadratically at the origin like the bound in, I'm going to use the same plot. So in the SUSY case, it turns out that the bound starts off tangentially to this line, and then it relaxes a little bit. But basically, at least for close to the origin, it kind of traces this delta S equals 2 delta phi curve. And, Ricardo fancies to speculate that perhaps it just should converge to the line delta s equals to delta phi? Well, who knows? So there's something funny going on there. You know,
because the AC computation, then you can make a comparison with the AC computations.
Yeah, you can make a comparison.
Or apparently you can do, you get both signs about it, or there's a recent paper by Xi.
Yeah. And then finally, just to finish, so far what we used this method in order to put, you know, basically limits on what is nowadays popular to say, to call swamp land of CFTs, to rule out, to say that such and such CFTs cannot exist, but, you know, in general, I think, so this idea of using crossing symmetry and OPE to construct CFTs, this idea is not new. It has been proposed 30 years ago, maybe 35 years ago, in the early 40 years ago by Polyakov and the others, basically when they were looking for a CFT theory of strong interactions. But at the time, first of all, this was very soon abandoned because the true theory of strong interactions was found, and then they didn't know the exact expressions for conformal blocks. They only knew some integral representations, so they didn't manage to push this program sufficiently far. But nowadays, you know, you could think that perhaps you could, you can hope that one day this technique may be used not just to, you know, to limit the swamp land and to put signs don't go there, but also to solve and to find CFTs, and, you know, we are clearly very far from that.
Numerical techniques, you essentially find the boundaries of this combo.
Yeah, essentially. So, you know,
you could also use it, you could find solutions.
Yeah, you can find solutions, but then you have to impose more and more, we are clearly not there yet, but I'm hopeful that if LHC is not coming up with any new physics and we have lots of times on our hand, then we will solve this problem. I'm hopeful. Thanks.
Currently you're trunking.
We are truncating, but we control the truncation sufficiently well. So asymptotics that we truncate away, we control them analytically. So we know that we are not losing anything.
We use a subtle point computation.
Yeah. I'm done.
But this was done in two dimensions. But the argument, of course, was then that two-dimensional conformal symmetry is infinitely more powerful.
Yeah, in two dimensions it was done, but in two dimensions indeed it was never just pure bootstrap, it was bootstrap plus extra tricks that you have in two dimensions.
Yeah.
And even like in the rational CFTs you make an assumption, okay, there's finitely many fields, and then you use analyticity, and then so it's clearly. So here you cannot use those tricks. So you have to be, on the one hand, more modest, on the other hand, more robust. And it's amazing that we can actually, as I say, we could have rediscovered the easing model without the, just because you make a bound in two dimensions and you get something like that. And then you think, well, I mean, this is not accidental. And this is the easing model point, 1.8.1. And you recover the central charge, everything, the OPE coefficients, exactly.
Sorry, my cousin said, when you say it was done in two dimensions, what do you mean by it? I mean, it's not as if this is a generalization of things that were known in two dimensions. This is new, even in two dimensions.
Yeah, I mean,
philosophically.
Was done solved,
finding a few solutions to the bootstrap in particularly simple cases was done, yeah.
So it's true, you need an expert, you know, you need complication. But you also have a much, an infinite dimensional algebra.
Yeah.
It's much more powerful, or just one. But in four dimensions, this would be enough.
Well, you see, yeah, there was we had a very nice discussion about these issues in Perimeter in April, and you know, whether bootstrap is enough, not enough, and so on. And for instance, Simeon had some conjectures that that it basically, you know, in some cases when you have global symmetries, and then you can truncate the OPE so that you throw out some fields which can never appear in the OPE by global symmetry. Those fields you will never discover just on the bootstrap. But modulo such things, there is hope that maybe it's enough.
But it's well known in two dimensions that the four-point crossing of the four-point function isn't enough for the modular invariance.
Yeah, in two dimensions. It's not.
Other questions for Slava? All right, let's thank Slava.